Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. So today we're adding another web page to the website. So we're going to add it to main navigation, so it pops up at the top bar there. And we've got a recommended YouTube channels page, so this time we're going to have a recommended websites page. And you can see you can set the URL ID, various other titles for it. Now there's a lot of pre-made sections that you can have on your new page. Menus, forms, online shops, testimonials, you name it. But we're going to go with a blank page and we're just going to add a module. Well, you can see there's a lot of different modules up to and including code, but we just want a simple text module into which we're going to put a handful of websites, which I keep finding myself coming back to time and again when I'm looking stuff up, along with a short description. Now, of course, this isn't the only set of websites that are really useful. I will be adding more as time goes on, but of course we only have about a minute and a half to tell you about all this. So we've got sites that host everything from naval weapons to photographs to movement records to primary documentation to user manuals of various periods covered by the channel. And with that done, just a case of sorting out how wide I want it to be, so it's all on one line each time, center justifying it, and the page is ready to go. So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenefell. You can get a free trial. And once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show. Though often unmentioned or underappreciated in the course of World War II, a small number of ostensibly obsolete World War I-era cruisers had a relatively important part to play in the war against aircraft at sea. Specifically, they were the C-class cruisers. Now, the C-class had emerged from World War I as the single largest class of modern cruiser built for the Royal Navy, a total of 28 hulls having been commissioned. Although they were rapidly superseded in capability in terms of small 6-inch cruisers by the D and the E class, those classes had a relatively small production run, and so the C class remained the largest part of the Royal Navy's cruiser force until the 1930s, when the more modern County, York, Arethusa, Leander, and Town classes began to take over. Thus, at the start of the 1930s, various subclasses of the C type began to be sold off for scrapping. This freed up tonnage and resources for more modern cruisers, since the First London Treaty did put a cap on the total number of 6-inch armed cruisers the Royal Navy could have. Those scrapped consisted mainly of the older subclasses, which had initially been built with a handful of 6-inch guns and a larger 4-inch gun battery, i.e. a mixed battery. However, the Royal Navy was also aware of the growing threat of air power. In 1932, a specific air defence committee had been formed and advocated for a significant increase in anti-air capability. But being a period well before radar, and before much of the pivotal work was done on high-angle dive bombing, the committee had focused on the possibilities of high-altitude level bombing, which may or may not become more precise over time, possibly with those aircraft in a shallow dive, and of course the low-level threat of torpedo bombers. Both of these types would be, relatively speaking, large aircraft due to their payloads, and they would be trying to approach the fleet in an approximately straight line. But thanks to aircraft spotting in the early 30s being done primarily by eye, it was expected that such attackers might only be spotted at something between 6 and 10 miles out from their target, depending on the size of the formation. It was expected that in a serious conflict, air attack might come from multiple directions at once, as it was thought, based on exercises, that something around 18 aircraft in a single attack formation on a given line of advance was about the most you could expect to organise before they just started getting in each other's way. And so, if a serious opponent who had more aircraft than 18 wanted to attack you, they would do so with multiple groups coming in on different vectors. And so it was critical not just to have all-around coverage, which of course meant having more anti-aircraft guns, preferably in twin mounts, as they didn't seem to weigh all that much more than single mounts, and of course doubled for firepower, but also to have multiple anti-aircraft directors. Since speed of aircraft was expected to just keep on increasing, the committee valued long-range anti-aircraft firepower to keep incoming formations under attack for as long as humanly possible, especially because they judged that breaking up incoming formations could be as, or potentially even more, useful than actually shooting down individual attackers, since, for example, it was much, much easier, both in exercises and, as it turned out, in wartime, to evade a couple of airdrop torpedoes coming in from aircraft that had been forced to dodge and then drop at a non-optimal launch angle, than it was to evade a dozen torpedoes coming from a formation that was mostly intact and flying on its preferred vector, even if from that formation you'd knocked two or three aircraft out at the last moment. Rather presciently, although as it turned out somewhat prematurely, the committee disregarded smaller anti-aircraft weapons on the basis that they'd only be able to take enemy aircraft under fire at very short ranges, and possibly not at all in the case of higher altitude attackers. And even then, things like the dropping distances for torpedoes would probably increase, which would pull the attackers out of range of small and medium anti-aircraft guns entirely. As a result, the report essentially advocated for heavy, long-range anti-aircraft weapons, with a handful of lightweight, close-range guns that wouldn't get in the way too much as last resort rapid-fire weapons for aircraft that got a little bit too close for their own good. They also advocated for a small number of anti-aircraft shells to be kept for the main guns of any cruiser or capital ship that had the elevation to make use of them, mostly as a marginal but potentially useful form of initial air defence at long distance, perhaps to box in an enemy formation in such a way that was more advantageous to the actual anti-aircraft batteries. They also advocated for a new kind of anti-aircraft fire control director, one that was far more complex and capable than the currently existing High Altitude Control System, or HACS. The problem was that in 1932, the after effects of the Great Depression meant that funds for the Navy were short, and so most of these recommendations went on ice until the mid-1930s, when the uptick in global tensions and a gradually recovering economy saw significantly more money being made available. This led to a comprehensive plan for fleet anti-aircraft upgrades being drawn up in the latter half of the 1930s, but world events had actually already overtaken things to some extent. The Abyssinian crisis of 1935 had seen the prospect of a war with Italy in the rather confined reaches of the Mediterranean, with the only aircraft cover immediately available to the fleet being the small number of fighters available to the Royal Navy's older carriers, since new, larger, purpose-built ships were not yet in service. HMS Ark Royal, the lead ship of that kind of vessel, had only actually been laid down that year. At the same time, Italy had built up a large and, at least for 1935, relatively modern air force. A stopgap solution was thus implemented on an emergency basis in the form of HMS Coventry and HMS Curlew. The C and D class hadn't featured at all, actually, in the Grand Anti-Aircraft Rearmament Plan, but these two ships were small and available, and thus quickly and critically cheaply converted. All their existing armament was removed down to the torpedo launchers, and then replaced with no less than 10 single 4-inch guns and a pair of octuple pom-poms, plus HACS directors to guide it all, and directors for the pom-poms. To accomplish this, where the two super-firing single 6-inch had been placed on the bow previously, there was now a 4-inch in the A position, and an octuple pom-pom in the B, or super-firing position. Moving further back, where there had once been a pair of single anti-aircraft guns of 3-inch calibre abreast the forward funnel, there were now two single 4-inch guns. The pedestal-mounted 6-inch gun amidships, just behind the funnels, along with its adjacent torpedo tubes, had been replaced by an echelon platform that had another pair of single 4-inch guns, which therefore had a limited cross-deck capability. The aft torpedo launchers were replaced by a pair of single 4-inch guns as well. And finally, right aft, the super-firing pair of single 6-inch were replaced with a 4-inch and an octuple pom-pom in the upper position, and a pair of single 4-inch on the centre line in the lower position. This turned out to be a surprisingly useful conversion and brought the C-class into discussion for conversion into further anti-aircraft vessels, since their utility, even as second-line surface convoy escorts, was becoming somewhat questionable. Since the Second London Treaty only restricted the tonnage per ship, as opposed to also setting an upper limit on overall cruiser tonnage as a whole, as the Washington and First London Treaties had done, there now wasn't any treaty-based reason to dispose of the remaining C-class, and they might therefore be made more useful, at least in the short term, until larger numbers of the planned Dido class and potential successors to that came along. The idea was similar to the modernisations then being done to older battleships. They could hold the line until newer designs took their place. Lessons were drawn from the conversion of Coventry and Curlew. The waist-mounted guns in place of the aft torpedo tubes had proved to have relatively limited fire arcs, and for this and various other reasons mostly to do with stability, they were removed towards the end of the decade. So most wartime plans and most wartime photos will show them instead with 8 guns instead of the original 10. Additionally, due to a temporary shortage of octuple pom-poms, the aft mounting of those guns was removed in 1938 for use on other ships, replaced for the moment with batteries of quadruple 50 cal Vickers machine guns. Thus, in April 1937, plans were drawn up for anti-aircraft conversions for the remaining C-class, based to a degree on the previous ones. However, this was quickly revised in two ways. The remaining ships of the Ceres and subsequent Carlisle subclasses could all be fitted to a similar pattern since they had the same original gun layout. But the 3 surviving ships of the Caledon subclass, as the Cassandra had been lost in 1918, were to a slightly older design. They still had 5 single 6-inch guns, but there was only one mounted on the bow. The superstructure was slightly further forward than on later ships, and what on other vessels was the super-firing forward 6-inch gun was instead placed between the bridge and the forward funnel. Those, it was thought, would therefore need a different design, and so in the interest of time and money, they were dropped from the programme for the moment. Unfortunately, although reprieved from the scrappers for the minute, the C-class were lower priority than the more frontline modern ships, and the programme was delayed, with still more delays thanks to a brief idea being forwarded to scrap the whole lot early and take the time and resources that would have been spent on them to upgrade several dozen older destroyers and sloops instead. This, it was argued, would create far more, if somewhat individually less capable, anti-aircraft platforms for a similar level of cost. As a result, only Cairo and Calcutta were taken in for conversion in 1938. Their revised layout, the second part of the delay, consisting of 4 twin 4-inch guns for a total of 8, plus a quadruple 40mm pom-pom. This was laid out with a twin 4-inch in the forward position, and then the quadruple pom-pom superfiring over it. The 3-inch anti-aircraft guns adjacent to the funnel were replaced with light AA. The pedestal 6-inch and the torpedo tubes there were replaced with 1 twin 4-inch, and then the 2 single 6-inch gun super firing aft were replaced by twin 4-inch each. The aft set of torpedo tubes were replaced with light anti-aircraft guns similar to the 3-inch guns forward. Although overall the number of 4-inch guns had been reduced by 2 compared to the original conversions, not only did it match what those latter ships actually ended up with by World War II anyway, but thanks to all the mounts being centerline, these guns could all fire on either broadside, whereas on the previous ships, there were 4 guns that had been mounted on the sides, plus the en-echelon mounts, which gave a 6-gun broadside on most angles, maybe 7 at a particularly perpendicular one, with the reduction in armament later on. Amongst the earlier ships with the single guns, they only now had a 5-gun broadside, maybe 6, again at good angles. Thus, the twin mount system with its 8-gun broadside was far superior. At first, it was planned to have 2 quadruple pom-poms in the same places, roughly speaking, as the octuple pom-poms in the earlier ships, plus two sets of quadruple 50 cal Vickers machine guns. But it had also been considered that maybe you could upgrade the aft quad to an octuple pom-pom and then have the super firing forward mount carry a fifth twin 4-inch system instead of a quadruple pom-pom. But top weight and stability prevented this idea. The reduction in pom-pom armament from two quadruples to a lone quadruple up front was partly addressed by the installation of more light anti-aircraft guns, but it was also largely a reflection of the need for quadruple pom-pom anti-aircraft mounts on other, newer ships, as demand was far outstripping supply. These newly converted ships would also only have a single main battery director, as to install two per ship would mean they'd have to wait several years, again due to other priorities across the fleet. The revised plan was to complete this conversion in a series of pairs. Curaçao and Carlisle would begin their conversions in 1939, followed by the Colombo and Cape Town, with Cardiff and Ceres from the planned list as yet unassigned, plus, of course, the three older Caledons. But, of course, war intervened. The first four ships were quickly assigned to various convoys, with secondary roles as naval base and port protectors. The third pair were upgraded in the early part of the war, as they'd already started the work when war was declared, and they emerged with slightly upgraded anti-aircraft suites compared to what had been planned. Carlisle, for instance, received a Type 280 anti-aircraft radar during her initial refit, which could both search for aerial threats and then feed ranges to the high-angle control system to aim the guns more accurately. Other ships would have to wait for such a system, assuming, of course, that they survived. As the war progressed, though, losses in both modified and unmodified ships, plus, of course, losses suffered to the rest of the fleet, were gradually increasing, and so there was a brief revival in interest in more conversions in the mid-war period. To this end, Colombo and, rather surprisingly, Caledon were called in. The other unmodified ships had received varying numbers of 20mm Oerlikons, but not much else. But the two newly refitting ships would be given a revised anti-aircraft layout. Experience had shown the necessity of mid-range anti-aircraft guns in the Second World War, and it had also shown that anti-aircraft ships tended to make themselves targets due to their aggression in the face of air attack. Thus, these refits only used three twin 4-inch guns, but in a new layout. There was now a pair super-firing forward and a single twin mount right aft, although these were now all equipped with remote power control. In place of the pedestal amidship 6-inch gun and the aft super-firing 6-inch gun came a pair of twin 40mm Bofors placed in the amidships area for a total of four guns, with more 40mm Bofors on the large platform that was now left in the super-firing position aft, with a variety of 20mm Oerlikons scattered elsewhere, the latter, as mentioned, appearing in many places on a variety of C-class hulls. This meant that a total of eight C-class were to one degree or another converted into anti-aircraft ships. Given the need for their services, they tended to have rather active lives, which were very often curtailed by a variety of enemy threats. Briefly, Coventry initially actually appeared to have quite a charmed life. Serving with the Home Fleet in the early part of the war, she was bombed at the start of 1940 while defending said fleet against the Luftwaffe, but after repairs she was sent to the Mediterranean, where she was torpedoed by an Italian submarine, but again repaired. She then saw action in various naval engagements, including the Battle of Crete, where she went to help a hospital ship that was being dive-bombed, being attacked in turn for her troubles, but surviving again, although once again being damaged. Her end, however, finally came when she was swarmed on the way back from a disastrous raid on Tobruk in September 1942 while in company with various other ships. Hit badly by four bombs in quick succession, she was then scuttled to try and allow the other ships to make a high-speed escape. Curlew, on the other hand, had a much shorter lifespan. While operating off Narvik in Norway in late May 1940, she was serving as an anti-aircraft guard vessel for ongoing British operations when she was attacked by Ju-88s, one of which managed to land most of its bomb load on her in one long stick. leaving her sinking, but with most of the crew able to get away. Her loss was felt particularly keenly at the time, not only because she was an anti-aircraft vessel, but because she was also one of the very few ships equipped at that point in the war with an air search radar. Cairo was also hit during the Norwegian campaign, but repaired, going on to see action in numerous Mediterranean convoys, including one engagement where she ended up trading fire with Italian light cruisers, highlighting the single biggest issue with the conversions, which was their inability to meaningfully protect themselves against anything bigger than a destroyer. Still, she survived that encounter with minor damage and continued in service until summer 1942, when an Italian submarine hit her during Operation Pedestal. Like the Coventry, she was then scuttled, in this case to allow the convoy to progress. Calcutta took minor damage, fending off German bombers at the Dunkirk evacuation, and like many of her converted sisters, ended up being sent to the Mediterranean, surviving multiple engagements there before being sunk in the latter stages of the invasion of Crete by two bomb hits from Ju-88s while she was sailing alongside Coventry, which picked up her survivors, before proceeding to the aforementioned encounter with a hospital ship. Curaçao started her anti-aircraft life operating off Norway, but was then sent to the western approaches to protect Atlantic convoys from long-distance German bombers, with a particular emphasis on escorting high-value ships. And it was in this role that she'd meet her end, not at the hands of aircraft or submarines, but in October 1942, at the bow of the liner Queen Mary, which she was escorting at the time, since the latter was carrying around 10,000 American troops. Unfortunately, due to some confusion as to who had priority, the liner ended up ramming the cruiser amidships during an anti-submarine zigzag operation, slicing her in half and sending her to the bottom along with most of the crew. Carlisle also started off her wartime career taking potshots at the Luftwaffe off Norway, before being sent to the Mediterranean, where she was damaged in the invasion of Crete, but unlike some of her sisters, she was repaired and resumed operations. But in October 1943, she was hit again, this time repeatedly by Stukas. She survived afloat, but once she was towed back to Alexandria, she was considered too badly damaged to be meaningfully repaired and instead was used as a base ship, seeing out the war in this manner. Caledon, being one of the two latecomers, bounced back and forth between the home and eastern fleets in her conventional role before being refitted in 1943, rejoining the action in 1944 with assignment once again to the Mediterranean. Here she did good service, shooting down a number of Axis aircraft, and she remained there until February 1945, when her age and a reduction in the numbers of overall Axis aircraft saw her recalled home to be placed in reserve, thus becoming the first ship on this list to survive the war without major damage. Columbo also served in the home and eastern fleets while she was armed with 6-inch guns, but she went into conversion slightly earlier than Caledon, coming back into service in mid-1943, sent once again to the Mediterranean, where she supported the Allied landings in Sicily before being tasked with Mediterranean convoy escort duty. She spent much of the rest of the war in this role, like Caledon finishing up in the Aegean, before being recalled to being placed in reserve in March 1943. On the immediate face of it, then, it may appear that the conversions weren't a good idea. After all, most of them ended up sunk, and a good number of those were sunk by aircraft. But on the other hand, when you look through their war histories, almost all the ships fought through numerous engagements with enemy aircraft before their eventual fates, and they were credited with a good number of kills. As was considered during the latter two conversions, they tended to make themselves very obvious targets and as such attracted far more than their fair share of attacks. Thus, they drew aircraft and bombs away from other, arguably more valuable ships, that were also less able to defend themselves. And so I would argue, they actually did the job they were supposed to, even if it came at a fairly high cost, overall preserving far more ships and lives than they ended up losing. But what do you think? Let us know in the comments below.